Welcome to our first meeting of the fall. I know we've all had very busy summers and, you know, really challenging times getting the academic year off, so thank you all for coming. As is our protocol, and I believe it's required, I'm going to ask everyone to introduce themselves. Of course, I'll start with Sally, who has her mouth full. No, no, I won't. I'll go. I'll start over there with, of course, lunch. I'll start with Pat.
I'm Pat Bannock, Director of Library Services at Eastern Connecticut State University.
I'm Chris Clark. I'm head of the History Department at the University of Connecticut.
I'm Martha Bedard, co-chair of this committee and vice provost for libraries at the University of Connecticut.
I'm Kevin Corcoran. I'm also a co-chair of this task force, and I'm the executive director for the Connecticut Distance Learning Consortium.
My name is Dan Barrett. I'm a psychology professor at Western Connecticut State and also the University Senate president.
I'm Jim Brunt. I'm an English professor at Gateway Community College.
I'm Greg Haddad. I'm the state representative from the 54th District.
I'm Saman Azimi. I'm a UConn student and board chair of Converg Students.
And I'm Clara Oba, Director of Library Services, Gateway Community College.
Sally Reese, finishing her bite of salad. Ed Psych Professor and Vice Provost for Academic Affairs at UConn.
Great, thank you. The minutes were sent out a few weeks ago, so I think we've had time to take a look at them. There were a few changes that came in over email that were we can be sure get into the official record. But are there any other changes, questions? Can we move forward with approval of the minutes? Okay. We have a motion to approve and a second. And I'm going to accept approval by acclamation. Okay, great. Thank you very much. As we discussed at our last meeting, we have agreed that we would like to hear from some of our colleagues in NACS. And Barnes & Noble, who are going to speak to us specifically about how they are engaged in open education resources, you know, what their own publishing model is, you know, how their own publishing model uses those resources and presents them to faculty as choices, and what the National Association is doing in that regard also. So, Richard, I believe that when we talked on the phone, we spoke about you kind of kicking it off and have organized a bit of the 20 minutes or so that we've given you to speak, and then we'll have left plenty of time for Q&A. Does that sound about right? Let's see. We have allotted 45 minutes for the entire time. We would like to have enough time for Q&A, at least 15 minutes. So, so half hour total, however you want to divide it. Okay. So, Richard, why don't you go ahead and take the floor.
I think what we'll do is I'll talk for a few minutes, then the folks here being in education will, and then we'll all come up, and then happy to engage in any conversation and questions you may have. As Martha said, my name is Richard Hirschman. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for the National Association of College Stores. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before this group today and have a good conversation about the role that college stores are playing in supporting specifically discovery, adoption, and use of OER. Those were the areas I had a call with Kevin and Martha that the task force would like us to focus on. And also initiatives that we're working on with OpenStax, which I believe all of you are pretty well familiar with out of Rice University. NACS is the Professional Education Association representing the collegiate and elementary secondary store community. Our members include primarily college and university-owned bookstores and other nonprofit entities like co-ops, which you're pretty familiar with here in Connecticut, and also companies that colleges and universities may partner with to provide services to bookstores or actually run their operations for them. Before I begin, I did want to just talk about sort of the related larger topic of textbook affordability very briefly before getting into some of the OER specifics. I've been working on this issue of textbook affordability for 14 years now, since I joined the association, transplant from K-12 policy work. And I think sometimes we lose sight of all the achievements that have been happening in this space. There's been a lot of effort. One of my first hearings that I attended and testified at was here in Connecticut many years ago, probably about 12 years ago, when there was concerns about the cost of college textbooks. And at that time, there was a lot of concern about bundling of textbooks. And I think there's been a lot of progress made over the years. Certainly, OER is one of those good examples. But we've also established a lot more student choice and transparency in the process. Faculty are much more aware of the cost of materials and how different options work. And students obviously have more choice from where they shop with the advent of the online marketplace. There's rental programs, digital with different price points, used books, buyback, which have been around for a long time. There's lots of different options out there today that there weren't even in 5, 6, 7 years ago. And that's helping control costs. And according to our student survey data and some other survey data, textbook spending has been relatively flat to declining over the last 7, 8 years. Now, that's not in every subject. It's not in every student. But as an average, student spending has been staying pretty good. And that's despite, you know, some improvements in the quality course materials and you know, significant price increases we've seen. For mostly new print and bundled packages. So we think there's been some good progress made. OER is part of that progress in the last few, 3, 4, 5 years in helping improve the process and improve affordability and also looking at quality. One of the areas I was asked to talk about is some of the things that's happening in the adoption process. In college stores, that's where they live. Working with faculty, trying to get adoptions in, it's been a long history of relationship of trying to get all of that information together to make sure that all the course materials are available by the first day of class. And, you know, historically there was a print form that you would fill out and submit to the store, and that's been the process for well over 100 years. And then as we moved to digital, those forms became digital and the submissions was there and there were improvements to those processes. But lately, and I think it really addresses what's been in the Babson survey, and it potentially addresses some of the issues in the Babson survey, our own faculty watch survey that I shared with Martha and Kevin and asked to be shared with all of you, is that there's, you know, certain barriers to the that faculty are telling us to adopting OER, from discovery to figuring out how to use it and comparing it to what other commercial options are available. So I think these tools, which I'm going to describe a little bit to you in the next couple minutes, and BNN can explain some more, are becoming much more robust tools designed to help faculty discover course materials and consider their options and factor in costs. With the greater focus on textbook affordability, several of these platforms, and I'll give you a few examples because there's a lot of different ones that colleges and universities are employing. Verba software now displays an affordability score index for faculty. So they can look at the textbook and say, how affordable is this product? And they're looking at it from not only what are other titles in that that are similar to that title, but also are doing price scanning terabytes of data on the internet and looking at new, used, rental, digital, what are all those price options? What's the amount of availability for those different options? And assigning a score to it. And they've got a pretty sophisticated algorithm. It's not the be-all and end-all, but it's a good starting point for faculty to look at something and say, how affordable is this? What's the likely cost that students are actually going to spend if I assign this book? And historically, folks have looked at the list price of the publisher. That price is increasingly completely irrelevant. Publishers price below their list price. Digital products are significantly discounted. So you need to look at it more sophisticated, and this is one effort to do that. Academos, which is a company based here in Norwalk, Connecticut, I believe they were a few years ago, and I think they still are, include OER materials in their affordability index. So they can say, you know, here's OER, which is free, and maybe print copy. How does that compare to other materials? Another company, Sidewalk Hero, has created a one-click process for faculty to negotiate for lower prices for digital commercial materials. Essentially, if a professor is interested in adopting digital, they can click on a button, and that will enter a process on the back end between the partners that are working with Sidewalk to contact the publisher and see what they're willing to come down in price. And they also can look at the affordability scale and say, all right, well, this is how much students could pay if they were using used books or rental. So whatever that digital price is, it's a real price for students. So they know they're getting a good deal or not a good deal. So these are all tools that are starting to be developed and expanded on that can really help arm faculty with better information. And you know, quality, meeting the needs of the course still rank is the number one priority of faculty. But cost is now becoming a much closer second, at least in our survey data. So faculty are weighing cost much more as they consider their options. Increasingly, these platforms are using are incorporating OER materials. Again, Sidewalk Hero maps out OER and other cost-effective content to national commercial textbooks, assisting in the proliferation of non-mainstream type content. So again, you could look at, here's this national well-known textbook in biology. Here is obviously an OpenStax biology book or maybe other content that's available. Some of the schools in the state partner with Follett. Follett has a product called Follett Discovery, and they allow faculty and administrators the ability to discover OER material that's coming from Merlot, which is out of the California State University system, OpenStax, YouTube, Khan Academy, and Coursera. So these sort of non-traditional or alternative sources of content can be easily accessed and presented alongside the commercial content so faculty can compare those. The product also can allow faculty to review who else is using the materials. So there's product reviews in most of these types of platforms. Of course, that relies, just like Amazon, on whether individuals, faculty, are submitting their reviews of these materials in providing grades or other comments. So it's always an important element of this is, are we going to get a critical mass of enough faculty participating and using these resources so that that feedback is provided. Follett's also increasingly, and also some of the other providers, are looking at library resources and trying to populate what the library currently has in its inventory and licensing and perhaps in print, and showing what's available at the library and then presenting that to faculty as well. And there's been a number of initiatives over the years. University of Kansas is one example that's been doing it for a while, where they're trying to reduce the duplication of students and the institutions effectively paying twice for the same content. So it's a little different than OER, but it's also another area where we're trying to look at how do we collect content that's going to be required of faculty or faculty want to use and get it into the hands of students in the most cost-effective manner. At Kansas, in some cases, the library decided that certain content just didn't make sense for the library to license anymore, and they sold through course packs at the bookstore. Other content migrated through the library. So these are all these kinds of different initiatives, and these platforms can help expand those opportunities to look at this content more uniformly. You'll hear a little more about BNN Education's Faculty in Light platform when they speak in a moment. The other topic I was asked to speak about is our partnership with OpenStax. College Stores have been involved with OpenStax for a long time, and this is the first OpenStax textbook, which actually predates OpenStax. It was at Foothills De Anza College in California, and the bookstore was involved in selling print copies in support of using OER, those OER materials. The bookstores also have been using, in that case, they supply the access codes for an online platform that's used in conjunction with that stats book from the author. Anyway, College Stores have also partnered with some pilot programs. City College in San Francisco distributed for free hard copies that were paid by a foundation that wanted to get faculty to consider using OER. The bookstore helped collaborate to get the faculty to agree in a certain department to use those materials. And then the bookstore provided the free copies that through the store that was paid through the foundation during the pilot. After a couple of years, the faculty decided to drop that textbook. A couple were okay with it, a few weren't. Store manager convinced them to keep using it for another term because they still had hard copies. And then that feedback loop went back to OpenStax. So. And, you know, OpenStax, like any other publisher, is improving their product and content, so a lot's being learned as this process goes on. NACS launched a formal partnership with OpenStax to address one of these issues of how do we get their materials out on a wider scale and address the needs of some faculty from a comfort level or a desire and students to have the option of a print copy, and do it in a more cost-effective manner. NACS has a subsidiary called NACS Corp. It's a warehouse. Sits across our parking lot. It was founded in 1963 to support academic presses because small colleges had trouble acquiring academic press titles for their students because there were minimum requirements. And so we work with OpenStax on how can we lower the price and also make the distribution much easier across the country. So in the fall of 2014, we had 237 college stores in the U.S. Purchase OpenStax titles through this initiative. This year so far, we're at 575 college stores have been acquiring the titles. We're trying to find ways to make that process even better. Next year, we may start implementing returns. These things are like custom materials to some extent, so stores have been hesitant, and there's been no returns on these, so stores have been hesitant to over-order for books, and you're never quite sure because the core product, the digital product, is free, what the student demand will be. In your package, you'll see in one of my slide decks towards the end, you'll see some examples of how at different schools, print sales have been of the print copy. At some community colleges, it can be as high as 70-80%, what we would call sell-through, number of students purchasing it that are enrolled in the class. At other schools, it might be only around 10% or 7% of students opting. A lot of it depends on the product itself. Some of OpenStax books are massive. I think we have a sample here. Others are smaller and more digestible online. So we've been working with them on that. The second initiative was announced this year, which is to create a platform that's starting to get rolled out this fall to create custom solutions for faculty who want to use OpenStax titles but don't want to use all the content. So they're very large books in many cases. So say they only want to use a few chapters. Maybe they want to add some of their own content. Maybe they want to add some commercial content. So we've created this platform in partnership with OpenStax and Dover Publishing, which is a commercial publisher, to allow faculty to go in, select the chapters they want, and on the right column see exactly how that affects the price of the print copy. And so they can see how the differences of content, how much content you add or delete, how much that affects the price if you want to offer print. And they can also offer digital, either free or an enhanced digital format for, I think, below $10. So that's an initiative we just started. This we announced in late February, early March. It's starting to get underway right now in some schools and pilots this fall. But it's another angle to approaching this issue. And so with that, I'm going to turn this over to the BNN folks, and then we'll get back to Q&A.
Thank you very much. I just want to mention that our UConn author, Ed Ness, new Adams First Chemistry book was delivered, I think, to NASCorp on the 6th. So maybe you brought it with you? It's probably not the one, but well, anyway, we're anxious to have copies of those in our Barnes & Noble University of Connecticut bookstore.
It's helped track the adoptions for OpenStack, so they may not be aware always of what faculty are adopting the material.
Right. So we'll hold questions, if you don't mind, until the end for all of you to save some time. And welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here representing Barnes & Noble Education. And thank you for inviting us. My name is Jay Chakrapani. I'm the Chief Digital Officer at Barnes & Noble Education. And what I wanted to share with you is some of the initiatives we have in driving affordability and affordable solutions for students. We run 770 stores across the country, and our primary objective is to be a service and support system for the students and faculty on campus. And we've always been that service partner in championing affordability. For example, as Rich was describing some of those discovery tools for faculty to look at the pricing of different course materials and be able to compare it, we also have a tool that we've deployed across our campuses. It's called Faculty in Light, and it's a portal that has over 250,000. It's a community of 250,000 faculty that provides a catalog of various course materials and the different pricing options based on format, whether it be new, used, rental, digital. We also include in that catalog OER material. So faculty have one place where they can compare and contrast the pricing and the affordability of these different materials options. Additionally, with our commitment to affordability, we also use our scale and our buying power to negotiate with publishers for more affordable options for students. And we do this with our first day programs, where we can negotiate lower per unit sales prices for the students for the courses that are taught on campus. So that's something, by using our scale, we can help drive more affordable solutions. And additionally, as I was describing, and as Rich was describing, affordability has always been at our core, you know, with the rental and used, and trying to scale that across our campuses. You know, OER is something that we see as another tool to help with affordability. And we know that OER exists, but in our surveys, what we found is that there's an awareness of OER, but there's not a mainstream adoption of OER. And we did a number of surveys to really dissect why that's happening. And, you know, we think the biggest reason is that there isn't that support system around OER that the publishers provide for their content. You know, publishers have sales reps. They visit the faculty. They, you know, work with them to educate the faculty on their materials, and then they handhold faculty through the process to get them to that first day. And then once the material is in use, they'll provide support, ongoing support for that material. So what we've discovered is we think that that's one of the biggest barriers to OER. Not that there's not good OER content out there. There is great OER content in the form of folks like OpenStax, but there isn't a sustainable model for its use. You know, one-time grants run out. It requires faculty, in our discussions with faculty, a lot of time and effort that they have to take on themselves to curate and organize that content. And if there's a lot of risk if something goes wrong, you know, there's no one there to help. And, you know, we also see on our campuses that the libraries are now stepping up to provide some of that help. And one of the areas that we're looking at is, with our scale, how can we provide even the library that support that we could provide that leverages our scale to provide more cost-effective support for the campuses that we serve. We also noticed that many courses are moving beyond the print textbook and going to full digital courseware. You know, what's great about digital is it's proving to be more effective in helping students learn. But the drawback of digital, it locks the publishers now can lock in the prices. You know, there is no rental market for digital. There is no used market for digital, right? So as things go more digital, all of a sudden the affordable options go away. So we see this is another risk that's happening around a threat to affordability. And finally, what we're noticing is, you know, with the print textbook and with with the OER that's out there, there are still a lot of gaps, primarily around assessment and test banks and instructor resources to help instructors adopt the material. So we looked at all this, and you know, we've been a champion of affordable solutions. We see OER as a new tool to help in affordability, but we also see gaps, and we are committed as Barnes & Noble to providing an affordable and sustainable models for OER use. And I think the key word is sustainable, because we also see that OER, there's a curiosity around OER, but there's significant barriers to making it pervasive. And so one area that we're helping with is around the awareness and efficient distribution of OER materials on our campus. So we work with partners like NaxCorp, NaxCorp and OpenStax to make efficient distribution of these materials in our stores. We also work with companies like Xanadu that can provide custom course pack solutions that include OER plus commercial content into a bundle that fits the learning objectives and syllabi of the faculty, of the courses that the faculty teach. We also have Faculty in Light that provides that discovery tool. But now what we're doing is we see as courses move digital, there needs to be an affordable digital option that can provide the benefits of OER and also the recognition that things are going digital and mobile, and provide that for the faculty and students as well. So we've launched in pilot form a digital courseware solution that not only includes the core OER text narrative material, but it includes the online homework, quizzes, and tests, the test banks. It includes a full-featured set of instructor materials and instructor resources that can be used to teach the class. And we partnered with OpenStax and David Harris at OpenStax to launch this. And we're active this fall in that program. And this is a digital, this digital offering is a full featured offering that not only has the, a complete set of content, including the assessments, test, auto-gradable assessments, test banks, and instructor material, but we also provide that service and support system. And this is really important because we think for OER to go mainstream, it's got to be as good and as complete as publisher solutions, including the support system around it. And so we provide program design with subject matter experts that can help faculty align the material to the syllabi and to the learning objectives of a course. We provide training and onboarding for faculty on our campuses. And we provide live phone and phone, email, and web technical support so that if anything goes wrong during the term, students and faculty have one place to call to get that support. And these are things that we think will pave the way for wider use of OER. And as I said before, we partnered with OpenStax to provide this digital OER offering. And today we're in pilot form this fall with three campuses, Penn State, Cuyahoga Community College, and West Liberty University. And we're actually seeking additional pilots for the spring and fall. So with that, I wanted to demonstrate that we're committed to affordable solutions in OER. And actually, one last thing I wanted to show you is, we work with NAX Corp to distribute these OpenStax books in our stores. But we've also worked with OpenStax to create a digital coursework companion. So these digital, this digital coursework that we're offering basically focuses on the digital part of it with the assessment and auto-gradable problem sets. But we also offer a print companion. And what we've done is, again, around affordability, is we've taken the OpenStax content, we've stripped out end-of-chapter problem material, put that online because it's more effective when it's auto-gradable and you get the feedback, and we've created a slim companion version that's optimized for the digital coursework. And what's nice is it gives that student, looking at a... it gives that student the ability to have the digital and the print at in one price that's very affordable. So with that, I thought maybe we could open it up to Q&A. Thank you.
Okay. So are we ready to do open questions and answers? Yeah. Clara?
Yeah, my question is on the print companion. When you buy the book, is it part of it? Is it free online on the digital form?
For the print companion?
Yeah, the companion.
The companion. So the pricing, we're in pilot form, so the pricing we're still working out, but we believe that we can offer this at about the bundle at about $50 to $60, digital and print, okay, per student.
Could I follow up on that? This is Pat, over here. It's okay. When you say $50 to $60, is that just for the companion, or is that for the print copy of the textbook and the companion print?
It's for the digital courseware, mm-hmm. So it includes the e-text material, the assessment, the we also have project-based activities and the test banks, mm-hmm. and the instructor resources, all digital, and a print companion for the student. So it includes everything.
So if I were a student and I just bought a OpenStax textbook, directly probably cost me $35, $40, depending on the subject. So I could get the whole package for $50 to $60.
That's what we're looking at.
Thank you.
We're going to spread the wealth. So, Richard, I'm going to have you up. So at the beginning, you had talked about student spending being somewhat flat, maybe a little up, a little bit down. And you had mentioned maybe OER was an offset in there. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are there other factors? Is there a cost avoidance piece? So when you look at the numbers or the data set that you have around student spending being somewhat flat or based on last year versus this year, what other factors are going into that? OER adoption is one. Is cost avoidance something you looked in? Is there other factors?
Yeah, we looked at cost avoidance. Well, first off, we started off on the textbook affordability issue with sometimes folks using some data incorrectly. So one of the data sets, and Max used to do it when I got hired, and I assumed it was accurate because it was the College Board. And so the College Board reports cost of attendance data reported by colleges and universities. And that's used historically for financial aid purposes. It includes books, supplies, and sometimes, depending on the school, other things. But it's primarily a category of books, supplies, equipment. Some schools add software. California institutions include internet connection costs. Sometimes when you hear the 1,200 or 1,300 or whatever that number is, it's really a budget estimate for undergraduate students that financial aid offices are trying to come up with as they calculate cost of attendance calculations for financial aid purposes. We've been conducting a survey now for many years and started asking about spending, and we looked at supplies as well. The National Center for Education Statistics has adopted our question survey design for their national survey that they do every 2 years on financial need. And that data will be out next year around July, summertime. They move a lot slower than we do as a federal government. But we feel pretty confident in our numbers, but we look at also unit sales and whether the unit sales are going up or going down. And we ask students also, have you opted not to purchase a book, and what's driving those decisions too? What we primarily see is that my view is it's a lot of different combination of things. But the data shows that rental programs, used books, the online marketplace, about over 600 college stores in the U.S. now do online price comparison. So you can shop on Amazon off our college stores' websites. BNN does price match guarantees now, and that's become much more the norm. There's a lot of different options for students, library reserves. All of this stuff kind of plays into it. And I think a number of faculty are also deciding not to use materials. Now, maybe it's OER. Maybe it's other content they're putting into the LMS. Sometimes maybe a copyright question, a fair use issue. But it's a lot of different factors. I think financial aid has also helped, though that's not reflected in the spending numbers because we separate those questions out. On the one hand, as tuition and fees increases, that means less grant aid available downstream from tuition and fees to cover books, supplies, transportation, housing, room board, gas, and all the other costs that are involved. But also the federal government established the American Opportunity Tax Credit. That helps a lot because it includes textbooks and can cover those costs that are unmet. But our data specifically says that if they look at unit sales aren't going down, at least in these last couple of years. So we're not seeing like students opting out, and that's what's driving the spending down. If you look at the questions, and we ask pretty balanced questions, why are you not, for those students that aren't acquiring, why are you not acquiring them? And this is the number one issue around college textbook affordability, and it's the perceived value of the materials. And I think you'll see in the Faculty Watch survey, you'll see a big disconnect between what the faculty perceive as valuable and the value perception of the materials versus what the students perceive.
And I remember being here 14 years ago when we were dealing with a lot of bad textbook bundles where there were a lot of things in there that faculty just weren't using, the publishers were marketing it, and nothing makes a student more upset than acquiring something that you didn't really necessarily want to buy in the first place and then not seeing it get used. And so perception drives a lot of that. And when you ask students why you're opting out of purchasing, and some students do tend to do that more than others, it gets to that perception. And in some cases, faculty, we're seeing, you know, because of our Higher Education Opportunity Act requirements to disclose textbook adoptions, we see material signed as required, but then are not, the faculty tell the students, I'm not using it. And sometimes that's a disconnect between adjuncts getting hired later in the start, close to the start of term, and a department making a decision. So it's a complex issue, but we feel pretty confident on our spending numbers. But again, they're averages. Community college students spend more, but that's not unexpected, because if you look at the composition of coursework community college students are taking, they're taking introductory courses, they're taking a lot of remedial courses, they're taking courses that use a lot of technology, supplemental learning materials. All those tend to be more expensive. Same thing in the first 2 years of four-year state institutions. Anyway, it's a complex issue, and I think but we feel pretty confident in our spending numbers. It's one measurement. There are other measurements, too.
Thank you.
Sorry, long answer to the short
okay.
question.
I appreciate that, and I'm sure you're aware of, you know, Phil Hill's.
Yep, and I've worked with Phil, and we've given him all of our data, and I mean, it's a concern we've had, particularly with the College Board, and I've met with them, and you know, you can look at institutions, and some institutions will increase their books and supplies budget on an X amount every year. UConn is at $850. That number hasn't been adjusted in years. Some institutions may be underestimating costs. Some institutions might be overestimating costs. I've seen an institution on the Eastern Shore of Maryland had $3,500 budgeted for books and supplies. It's complex because it's really up to the institutions and the student financial aid offices to determine how these numbers get worked out.
Let me ask you one additional one, and then I'll pass it on. When you had mentioned the affordability index, you had mentioned a handful of sites, including Academos, Sidewalk, Hero. There was one that you mentioned at the start of that conversation. I missed that.
Okay, Verba Software. Verba is an interesting company. It was a startup. It's now based in California. It started by a couple of Harvard students who got kicked out of the Harvard coop. This was many years ago, for writing down ISBN numbers. They didn't like that, and they worked to change that. It was around the same time we had the Connecticut legislation requiring ISBN number posting. And so they, shortly around the time the Higher Education Act was passed in 2008, they had started a company. They were like a lot of other folks were like, well, let's, you know, do sales online or affiliate connections to online retailers. And they looked at the model and talked to a lot of college stores and realized they weren't necessarily the enemy here. And so they developed software tools to help support college stores with transparency. So one of these things is this marketplace, so students can compare prices of the store. It also gives the stores a lot of data, so they better understand pricing of online, because it's changed. We used to have, in a traditional retail sense, you had a markup, and that was that. You cover your operating costs. But online retailers don't operate that. They use dynamic pricing. Amazon changes prices hundreds of thousands of times a day. So they are providing a lot of information and tools to support stores and faculty in some of these new initiatives. So it's a pretty cool company. We've been partnering with them, it's a neat little product that they've been developing.
Thank you.
Questions? Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, this question is for both of you. So what is your core message for us at this point here? Is it that this is already being done by so many folks out in the community that at state level we need to do nothing about it? Or is that there are things that we should do at state level in Connecticut that you can help us figure out what's most effective and efficient? Or so what is your core message to us as a group trying to figure out how to solve this problem in Connecticut?
I'll take the one lead. I mean, there are a lot of state. I mean, I get to track all of this stuff, and I remember in Pennsylvania once I met with a legislative staffer and she was trying to tell me what a section of the bill was, and I was like, yeah, no, I wrote that many years ago. It doesn't mean exactly what you think it means, but there's a lot of activities. I think you shouldn't necessarily try to reinvent the wheel. And I think you've heard that from others testifying and meeting with you. I think it's very important that all stakeholders be at the table, even publishers. Campus is really important. I mean, and I think, you know, a lot of you who've worked on OER so far on your campuses know the importance of having a pretty expansive group of folks involved. And, you know, higher ed's full of silos, and it's important to try to break those down. So on our list, we always look at, you know, obviously academic affairs, the library, the bookstore. Disability support services is one that often isn't included, and I think it's really important that the DSS folks be included in the conversations on course materials. We've got some other things we're working on in that space. IT, registrar. I mean, there's a lot of different elements there. And then obviously, and you have a lot of new folks, instructional designers and folks that are sort of new positions on campus. So my message is, I think, from a task force, there's been a lot of work on this. We work with Affordable Learning Solutions at CSU. There's Affordable Learning Solutions in Georgia. There's some efforts going on in Oregon and Washington. There's some folks to emulate and copy. I don't think you need to create some massive, you know, agency or effort here in Connecticut. But it's good to have a network and have the right folks at the table and share information of what you're doing on your campuses. So kind of be a convener, I would say, is where I see a good role for the state.
So I think our message to you, and sort of echoing what Rich was saying, is there's a lot of great models to emulate. Just to give you a bit of my background, prior to Barnes & Noble Education, I was the president of the CK-12 Foundation, an open OER foundation for K-12. And so the biggest barrier that we found in the K-12 business, in K-12 OER, which we also see in higher ed OER, is making a glide path for faculty for a safe glide path to transition from high-priced resources, right? You know, because it's sort of the Wild West. A faculty member would be going from something that may be expensive but is safe and secure and proven to something that they have to take a little bit more responsibility on. And so getting that, you know, making it easy for faculty to make the transition, I think, is the biggest hurdle we've seen. I've experienced it in the OER Foundation that I ran, or I was leading, and I see it here in higher ed. And one of the things that we're committed to at Barnes & Noble is to providing that service and support to help that transition be easier. And whether it be working with the library and providing low-cost support services that the library can deliver, working with departments, working with faculty to provide training and support. You know, that's what we're trying to solve. Like, we've really pinpointed that, you know, it's not the great content is out there. Mm-hmm. There's great models to emulate. But the biggest thing is, you know, the elephant in the room is, you know, the inertia that exists for faculty to feel safe to move to OER. And if you can pinpoint that and solve that, and work with partners that you see fit, you know, I think then we can take this and blow it out mainstream.
Yeah, one thing I'd quickly add too is I think it's very important that you're very clear about academic freedom,
yeah,
and letting faculty make the decisions and drive the adoptions. Cost is important, obviously. OER is part of that, though it's not. Adopting OER over cost is not the only consideration, and there's other benefits to OER. But being very clear about academic freedom up front. I've seen some state efforts that you know, either legislatively or otherwise, have sort of kind of made some folks nervous in the academic side of the house. And I think it's very important that even though that's not the intent, to that you're very clear and upfront about preserving faculty choice. I mean, there is a risk when the state, making this for representatives' benefit, there is a risk when the state gets involved in something, funds it. And I worked on a lot on appropriations in the federal level. If you fund it and no one comes, and then you go back and the legislator wants to know what they got for their money, and there is an instinct to say, well, let's mandate they use this or that. So I think that's something you have to always be very careful of. And I think what we're seeing today in the OER movement is a combination of both bottom-up and some top-down. And I think that's the right mix. I think you need to have both.
Thanks. We have a couple more folks who have questions in our next few minutes. Pat?
I wanted to know how your profit margins work in this arena. I mean, obviously, you have to stay in business. And I kind of see this as an analogy to what went on in the library space with open source library systems, that commercial entities came in to support them, because it's true that something that's open source does need support. So how do you make money?
So what we see is that the content is there, so it's not that we want to mark up the content, but the service and support, what we can do is we can hire subject matter experts, we can hire a call center that can do tech support, but we can amortize the costs across 770 stores, right? So where we can make money, and it's not gross amount of money. It's where we can actually operate our business is by the fact that we can amortize cost across our scale. But we see that just like in the open source software movement, there are companies like Red Hat and IBM that provide professional services and support. There are ways to make money, but it's not by selling the content. It's really saying, if you have scale, then your operating costs can be managed through scale. That's how we want to do it.
Yeah, and from the nonprofit side, I mean, it's an issue. I mean, we have in Oregon and Washington, where there's been some very heavy adoptions of OER, it's impacted the store's bottom line, which is, it's a nonprofit. It's part of the institution. It's not subsidized like other departments on campus, yet they're still expected to do all the things that they're doing and pay for software systems and provide services and all these other things that, it may not be very cost effective. It's like college stores are not traditional retailers per se, because most of the, particularly the community college, most of the product they sell, they don't get to choose what product to sell. So they have to sell everything that's assigned. So one of the things that some of our California institutions have been looking at is how to get the institutions in the state to recognize that there are costs of operating course materials on campus, and that maybe it's time for institutions to not necessarily see as stores as a revenue generator, but as a service, and to supply the funds needed to at least maintain certain functions of the store. I mean, just to put you in some context here, in a large state institution, you may have about 13,000 adoptions of different unique titles. At a semester-based institution, about a third of those are changing every term. At a quarter school, it can be even much higher. It can be over 50% of those materials are changing every term. There's a lot of content out there. Not all of this is going to be able to go to OER. I mean, there's a lot, and a lot of it shouldn't necessarily. I mean, there's a lot of very affordable trade book materials and history and other areas that really aren't, necessarily the issue, unless, the professor adopts 12 books. And, they were $4 or $5, but when you add up 12 books together, it adds up.
Literature course.
Right. Yeah, and we've had stores say to the faculty, "Hey, you just sent this adoption for 12 books. That's a lot of students are going to be able to buy it."
Thank you. I think Dr. Clark does have a question.
Yes, thank you very much. I've found this very enlightening, and I actually had Pat's question as well, which was how will profit continue to be generated in this system? But thinking back to Dan's question and looking to the future, because, I mean, this task force will cease to function, presumably, at some point, but the unless it becomes a standing committee of some sort, but the problem of affordability is going to continue. And so one question would be, would there be data that would be available from either of your institutions in the years to come that would enable those of us in the higher education system who are concerned about affordability and legislators to kind of monitor whether the developments that you're talking about it are actually having an effect on the affordability? In other words, could we see a depression? We're assuming that there's a problem now because prices have inflated. And they've inflated in some areas clearly very much more than in others. So, you know, I can pay the same amount now for a history monograph, a big one, that I paid in 1975. But if I'm buying Greg Haddad's chemistry textbook from the 1980s, I probably pay 10 times as much as he did then. And so clearly there's something going on. Will there be data available to oversight committees and to higher education institutions that will enable us to see whether the things that you're doing are helping us?
Yeah, so I don't know how much you ever heard of the name Erskine Bowles, or the Simpson Bowles Commission in Washington. It was an effort to, was a Clinton appointee and became at one point chancellor of the North Carolina system. Well, he was concerned about textbook affordability, and he required that before an institution would submit their request for the coming budget year, that they had to show what they were doing to address textbook affordability. And so they developed a system with a professor, a way of better tracking net cost analysis of what students are actually likely spending. It was tracking more on the pricing side than the spending side, on what students were spending. But those numbers have tracked pretty close for the stores that have continued to do that survey since he left. The system stopped doing it. But some of the schools are still doing it. But they are tracking very closely where their numbers are going on what it's getting adopted. They're including OER into that tracking. They just had a meeting a few weeks ago with the library to discuss how to integrate that data in. They also track courses without any adoption, which may be OER, maybe other stuff. But anyway, there is a system, there is kind of an approach to do that. I've always wanted to see us do that so we avoid, you know, price comparison, savings claims or savings measurements that are based off of list price with 100% students, you know, assumption of 100% students are buying. And, you know, our industry's done it. When textbook rentals, you know, put out press release, $1 billion savings, everyone kind of uses the list price and assumes every student's buying new books, which we know is not the case. But I think there are ways to do it, and we've had some conversations about doing that.
Perhaps, you know, the PIRGS will continue to monitor this too. So I'm looking at someone, and we know that COMPIRG and U.S. PIRG and our own Ethan Sendek, who's a UConn alum, has continued to send out OER watches and paying close attention to this. So I guess we'll look forward to some other groups that will also be providing some good data.
And we've worked with PIRG, U.S. PIRG, and Mass PIRG, and Oregon PIRG for years on a number of reports and issues, and we work closely with Ethan One of the things I mentioned on our call was we do a textbook affordability conference. We've done it now for 2 years in a row. Next year we'll be in Atlanta. We're working with the Affordable Learning Solutions Georgia on that. And I got an email this morning saying we wanted to ask Ethan and U.S. PIRG to be a co-sponsor to that. He attended the meeting last year in California. So
great.
We're working with them. I think the more data points, the better.
Good. Well, thank you. One last
just one
minute.
Last thing. So just to add to that question, tracking data around affordability, that's one part of it, but also looking at does it result in an outcome, right? Looking at the data and saying, you know, whether it's expensive or inexpensive, does it track to the outcome?
Yeah.
And one of the things that, you know, in working with David Harris at OpenStax, the platform we have, it's called the Loud Cloud platform. It's an analytics platform. And one of the things that he liked about what we were doing with his content is tracking behavior and performance data to the learning objective and skill level so that we can give him data on the effectiveness of his content. You know, how much is it being used? How much is it not being used? Is it resulting in student progression? And so that was one of the things that we're working with him on.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I'd sort of like to call this part of the session to a close and thank our guests, but I'd also like to then have a conversation among ourselves. So, of course, you're welcome to stay. It's a public meeting, but I think that if we pose any more questions, we can pose those to you as part of our conversation. And I do appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Yeah. A lot of things come to my mind as I've listened and as we've been meeting for several months here that, that perhaps at some later date we can communicate with these folks and others, but just my quick observations, if you don't mind, are around the need to add more content to these platforms that have that the publishers use for discoverability. There's much more than out there than I think is being currently made available, and perhaps they have plans for that. We'll be talking in a few minutes about our own survey. I do think that it's important that we conduct the second part of that survey. We've done UConn and we do the rest, so that we really can see where our own barriers are here in Connecticut and how they compare with the barriers that these folks have talked about in various surveys have. The challenge of a support system is something that I think will come out as part of a report. You know, libraries have been taking up, you know, the flag on this, but we can't carry that alone, and we don't have the resources to do it. So I very much appreciate the support system piece that will allow this to be sustainable, which then leads to how do you mainstream OER, which is another comment one of our presenters made. So as we think about our own, what we want to talk about in the next couple of months and in our own final report, and then assessment, and then I'm going to look at Sally. I think she was ready to make a comment on that, and we do need to assess the effectiveness of these materials. So those are just the things that as I was listening and contemplating what we have been hearing come to my mind that we might want to plan for further discussions. And so now I'll just open it up to anyone else's general comments or questions that you want us to pursue.
Yeah, my comment is really, I think, a follow-up to Daniel's, and that is that I think most people are looking at textbook rather than just resources. And the OpenStax listing is small. So, you know, when you get an email from the Dean of Nursing that says our textbooks are really interested and I really would love to do something, but there's nothing in nursing. So we did a quick look at the most frequent, largest class sizes at UConn. So just a few things. Philosophy doesn't have an OpenStax textbook. Engineering doesn't have one. Communications, that had 1,000 students each semester, doesn't have one. Linguistics, that has 900 students a semester, doesn't have one. Engineering, that has intro to engineering, hundreds of students, 700 or 800 students a semester, doesn't have one. So I think what happens sometimes is faculty that might get interested go to look for a textbook, don't see it, and then they're off to something else. So the one thing that we're doing at UConn is we're going to offer a financial incentive for faculty to, and we're going to have class size and number of students affected, you know, by the textbook cost, for faculty to volunteer to write or adapt. Now, it's going to have to be right. That's the challenge, because these are not yet written, and we're thinking of a $10,000 stipend to faculty in these areas of high need. That's equivalent, you know, to a month or so of summer salary, depending upon the age and the level of the faculty member. But that's something, you know, we'd want to let everybody else in the state know, because if we do get somebody in engineering to write a book at UConn, it would be wonderful to reach across the state and have partners across other universities join us, or, you know, in even more generic areas. Not that engineer is generic, but not everybody has an engineering program, but I bet every school at the every college in Connecticut offers an intro to philosophy class, for example. So this is something we've just committed to. Representative Haddad was kind enough to join us at a press conference about this, and we wanted to let all of you know we'll be starting, you know, our discussions with faculty that teach these large classes. But to me, it's a problem when people go to OpenStax and they just don't see anything, and therefore they immediately leave and say, okay, there's an American history textbook, but there's no European history textbook. There's none. There's no world history textbook. So these you know, they're big gaps, and if we could help by this task force fill some of those gaps, because that's really the reduction of the biggest expenses, I think, the textbooks, as opposed to the other resources. So that's what we're going to do at UConn.
That's great, and I will also say that that's a part of the awareness is the growing corpus of materials that are available. So the things that we can fill in the gaps for are great, but the discoverability of so few of these right now through these platforms, and it goes to one of the barriers in one of the studies we sent out, which was not having a catalog of sorts. Greg, you have a question?
Yeah, and a comment. One is just to say, I think it's great what the University of Connecticut has decided to do, and it's great that they have the resources to be able to do it. That might not be the case across all of our institutions in Connecticut, and so I think that that's probably a good place to look in terms of a recommendation of this committee moving forward, to make sure that other institutions might also have the ability to do some kind of a similar effort, if that we think that might prove helpful. I just want to say, coming out of the presentation from Barnes & Noble, there were a couple of times when I kept having a recurring thought, and I'll couch it in the sort of the glide path comment. And the academic freedom comment. I mean, I think it's very clear that we need to maintain academic freedom, and that professors and faculty should have the ability to make the decision for themselves about what materials they should use for their courses. At the same time, you know, the infrastructure that was described that it exists in support of the traditional textbooks includes these campus reps. And this came up when I was visiting Barnes & Noble earlier this week at the UConn campus, and in a couple of different ways was alluded to today. And I just have conjured up a vision in my mind of, you know, that those professors who teach very large introductory courses and the students are going to be using a lot of textbooks have a line of reps outside their office door. Pharmaceutical sales started, you know, models started popping in my head, and all this sort of stuff. And it seems to me like that's, you know, those folks are intended to sell the product to professors, but also as part of that sort of comfort zone that professors have to find themselves in to know that the materials are going to be available and are going to be what they're looking for. And
And that doesn't exist with the open source stuff. I think that's the point. And so, like, how do we level the playing field a little bit, I think, is would be an important kind of a conversation to have. And I'm encouraged that, you know, the libraries and others have already begun to think about that process. But I'd be interested in knowing if there's something we could do more substantially across institutions.
Pat?
I was really encouraged by what Sally was saying about UConn, you know, having this stipend program. And I think that's one of the big barriers, is that we all know the state of Connecticut is in cutting mode, not adding mode. But sometimes a small amount of seed money can save a lot of money in the long run. So if there were some way to leverage what UConn is doing with some similar type of program, let's just say at the Board of Regents, for example, or something that was available to private colleges to support their faculty, because faculty are not going to do this on their own time. I mean, it's totally unreasonable to expect that. So without some kind of funding model like they have in the state of Georgia, it's only going to be little pockets of support. And it would be great if, you know, if we knew that UConn was going to do a philosophy textbook, but there was a lack of some other, you know, gen ed kind of textbook, then one of the other partners would say, okay, we'll do the European history textbook. But that's not going to happen if it's just UConn, because they don't have endless pockets either. So I hope we can find some way to leverage what they're doing.
I think that's great. The other thing is that has come up, and I know that this has come up among this group and comes up all the time with students, is the concern that the ancillary materials, those tests and quizzes and so on, will end up escalating in prices so much that it's not, they will, that the fact that the text is free will be then irrelevant because the cost of the other materials will go up. So I'm not asking this group to respond to that, just to state that that's something that I know the same folks who are being heavily funded by foundations such as Gates and Mellon and Sloan are looking at those kinds of things also, which might lead into, you want to maybe talk about my open math and the incentives for that? Would you mind?
No. Before I get into that, to piggyback on Pat's comment, I think I don't know if it was Richard or Jay who had mentioned Cal State. Cal State's been mentioned a lot within this committee for the work they've done. So Affordable Learning Solutions is one. You know, they have multiple platforms that built off the Merlot code base. So another one that's Cool for Ed that has been adopted in it for SUNY and for Georgia and other places. So where we're talking about a statewide effort, the Cool for Ed program allows for faculty review of materials. So you have a collection of things that have been vetted by Connecticut faculty against whatever standards we want to address. So it's not that we have to go always to that half a billion global repository across the, you know, how many different repositories, that there can be this considered effort that even at a review moment of somebody else's material, that there can be something that is a Connecticut reviewed and blessed piece, and then we can find the gaps where there is missing ones and focus those. So if we agree that OpenStax meets 10% and that Merlot has, you know, what have you, or the Open Textbook Library out of Minnesota has another 10%, we can have these vetted, reviewed resources as a collection for Connecticut and then address those, so we're not replicating what's already out there. But to talk about opportunities that are happening, and what's happening at UConn is fantastic. I've alluded to this in the past, that the Board of Regents finally has an opportunity to do a little bit of funding. What we're doing is a pilot program for math departments. So one of the tools that's adopted somewhat in support of PA 1240 is Pearson's My Math Lab. And at the current cost point, for students, it's about $260 for the combination of the access to the My Math Lab homework site and the text with that. So based on Housatonic Community College's model, where they've gone with the MyOpenMath, which is now supported by Lumen, and then a textbook that was, or workbook, I should say, that was developed out of Scottsdale, Arizona, they've reduced the cost burden to students to $30 if they opt for the print version, zero if it's digital. So those faculty members who started this initiative out of Housatonic for no compensation have played mentor to other folks at Housatonic, so it's now 20-plus sections wide at that institution, but they've also played mentor to Tunksis and Middlesex Community College and others. So they've been kind enough to help mentor this sort of formalized program where the Board of Regents is allowing stipends or awards per campus for all 17 institutions for their math departments to get into this. So there is a kickoff event on September 30th at Middlesex Community College, which is a three-hour session. The first hour is presented by Lumen Learning, where they're going to talk in broad strokes about open education. So it's a all-audience invitation. The second hour is specific to MyOpenMath, to talk about the tool as a multidisciplinary homework tool. And then the last hour is the Housatonic faculty talking about their specific adoption and how they plan on mentoring any award winners. And also other faculty who are in the process of adopting or have recently adopted, including folks at Middlesex, are going to also speak about their experience in adopting this low-cost, no-cost tool. So we're excited that there's movement and that there's a pilot effort afoot at the Board of Regents.
And I know that OpenStax also has a full suite of math from pre-calc all the way through algebra-based calc to other math. So if you had also that MyOpenMath tool. So I'm hoping that the folks at UConn will take a look too. You want to take it over?
Sure. We're flipping the agenda just slightly. So based on the conversation that Barnes & Noble and Max was able to do, there's a lot of topics or a lot of themes that are sort of touched on the two data sets that we provided. So there was one that was done by the state of Florida through their consortium, and then there was an updated Babson report. So those are two links that were provided along with the agenda. And I don't expect everybody to have that at their fingertips, but I just wanted to talk about some of the themes that I think were important, were somewhat illustrated here today. It's great that OpenStax has become this well-recognized name brand, but it seems, at least in some of the Babson data, is that it's the only name brand in OER that faculty will understand, and there maybe is a disconnect that OpenStax equals OER. So they may understand what OER is in a general sense, and they may know what OpenStax is, but they're not making the connection to the two, that they're one and the same. One of the other elements that's in the Babson report is that there may be an understanding of licensing. They may have some awareness of Creative Commons. They'll have a better understanding of commercial licensing, but they also don't understand that OpenStax is something that's utilizing Creative Commons. So there's pockets of information that don't seem to be connected for faculty based on the survey data. And also looking at sort of the general awareness piece, there's a slight increase of faculty awareness across those who are very aware, somewhat aware, or aware, but it's a slight gain. It's only about 5%, considering how many states and countries and systems have had OER initiatives over the last 2 or 3 years. So to the point where there's this awareness, but awareness doesn't necessarily translate to adoption. So I think one of the questions we asked is, what should we do or what's needed? I think there's still further education needed that's connecting those dots between here's what open is, here's how it relates to your academic freedom, your choice aligned to your outcomes, and then making that transition so that there is a connection between copyright to student benefit to faculty benefit, and I think it's to Jay's point, making that there's a smooth transition so that there aren't these barriers. Both the Florida report and the Babson report go into quite a bit of detail on the barriers that faculty see, and it's not anything that we haven't already discussed. It's about supplemental. There may not be enough resources. I think, Sally, you just said this. There may not be enough resources in my particular area, or there may not be supplemental materials. There may be concerns about frequency of revisions or updates or the quality of those updates. I think within the Florida report, there were also some concerns about the support mechanism for faculty to adopt these. It was one of the pieces that was very interesting about the Florida data results is, and not to suggest a contradiction, but when they were talking about students reducing their costs, they were talking about it in a variety of means. And one of the interesting elements that they did here is that about 64% of students were now purchasing their textbooks from other sources besides the campus bookstore. And you know, I know that there's some data in here. And based on that, there's about 30% that are renting versus buying. And it was only about 3% that were opting for lifetime access to a digital version. So there was some interesting data that was coming out of the Florida data set. And they echoed some of the same things that Richard mentioned, is that the community college students are spending much more based on introductory materials than the four-year university students. I'm just curious. I'll stop rambling for a moment and wonder if anybody else had an opportunity to look at either data set and have any observations or comments.
Is that information about the relatively high costs for community college students, for example, or for first and second year students, is that largely to do with the types of courses they're doing, or is it also to do with the kind of information that is available to students about how to go about acquiring materials? That one could imagine a situation in which if you're in your third or fourth year of a degree course, you've started to learn the ropes a little bit, and you might be better at figuring out where the deals are, but that perhaps if you go to a community college, it's your first semester, you've not been to college before, you don't actually know anybody else at this point, you have, how do you know how to go and get a textbook except to do what it says in the syllabus, which is go to the college bookstore?
I think that's a great point. I think maybe Richard might have mentioned that, you know, with four-year universities, there's some type of cut score, acceptance criteria, so you may not be dealing with the same amount of remediation that a community college, especially in Connecticut where it's open enrollment, if I'm correct. So where you have an AccuPlace that's more of a placement piece, it's not necessarily a cut score for your skill set. So there may be costs associated with that remediation piece, and I know that the Pearson My Math Lab is being used for remedial math programs as well as general math or credit-bearing courses. You know, it's an interesting conversation. I think that there's a broad-based conversation as a student, as a consumer, which I don't think anybody really wants to have that conversation, but there are alternate paths to credentialing that students are seeking out, whether it's CBE, prior learning assessment, C-capping of credits, test out with CLEP and Dante's, utilizing other institutions for lower cost tuition dollars, and then transferring to, you know, institutions where they're going to complete their major. That may be a good element, that there isn't necessarily wide knowledge of how to be a better consumer.
So, I mean, would there be scope for us to consider recommending how that issue, if it exists, might be addressed?
I would say yes. You know, one of our roles is being student advocates. Saman, do you have an opinion?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it could very well be a factor, and that, you know, I mean, I was lucky. I have a sibling who was in university before me. And so I came in knowing how to avoid spending a lot, and I did. But yeah, if that's something that we could also address in terms of student awareness of options, I think that would absolutely be important.
I just want to say that if there is a connection with community colleges and the high cost of textbooks, it could be related to the pressures of remediation. And with PA 1240, there's a very limited time frame that we have to push these students through remediation. And when they show up, and they're reading at a second grade level, and we have one semester, to get them ready for college-level work, it's led to, in some cases, the adoption of some very expensive materials. So if there is a connection and it's tied into any form of remediation, I'm sure it lies there with PA 1240.
I think that's an excellent point. I also see that there's national data that basically suggests that community college students on average are spending more than four-year institutions. But I think it's an excellent point. I think it's something that Richard reinforced just a moment ago.
Also, if they use financial aid to get textbooks, can they go to Amazon? I don't believe they can.
I'm not a financial aid expert, but what I can understand is I know that there are book vouchers that I think there's an avenue that folks can go out of pocket and submit for reimbursement for alternate means of purchasing, meaning not using the campus bookstore, but it does require an out-of-pocket expense. You want to, I don't know.
Well, this relates to a question I was going to raise at some point anyway. I mean, one of the things that struck me particularly forcibly about from our presentations today is the role of student financial aid calculations about budgets. Now, I mean, I know very little about student financial aid or how that gets worked out, but I was struck by the disparity in the figures that we were given. That, you know, a college in Eastern Maryland allows $3,500 per whatever unit it is, and UConn apparently is $850 and hasn't moved for years. And so I know we're concerned here with making things available more cheaply, but since our concern is affordability and, you know, whether students without means can afford college education, then maybe we should at least have a recommendation in our report that the question of financial aid budgeting and what calculations are made ought to be taken up by the higher education systems. I realize that's a complicated question, but if there were more money coming to the students' pocket to begin with, then affordability becomes easier. And Barnes & Noble will continue to make its profits.
I also wanted to follow up on that support and marketing piece. Because when you look at the model that the commercial publishers have that's been described with the sales reps from the publishers approaching the faculty with the large courses and so forth, which is perfectly, you know, good way to conduct business, and then you look at the open source situation where you don't have a dedicated person to do this. And I know in my own situation, I am trying to become the OER evangelist at Eastern, and it takes a lot of time to, you know, familiarize yourself with what's out there. And I know that I am not the expert on every OER repository for every subject. I mean, yes, I can go to OpenStax and see what they have too, but I think that's part of the issue, is that there is a lot out there, but we don't have the sort of marketing model or the staffing model that supports this. And so when I tell the librarians, you know, you need to be the expert on OER in your liaison area, it's not like they don't support it theoretically, but then it's like they also feel like they have a lot of ground to cover, not only to do the outreach, but God help them if the faculty member actually responds and then says, yeah, you know, I really would like to use OER for my, you know, course in modern European history. Well, then there's the question of, you know, what's suitable, how suitable, does it really meet the course needs? All of this is something that the sales reps do, and they only do it for one publisher at a time.
I think that directly goes back to also the newest Babson survey coming out in July that came out in July that you were given, and so of the 3,000 faculty that were surveyed, still most are unaware of OER but are interested in giving it a try. The most significant barrier still is the effort required to find and evaluate such materials. On the data table, no comprehensive catalog of resources is at the very top of the list. So I do think that we have, and too hard to find, not enough resources is on there, but nowhere near as far enough as, you know, I don't even know where to find them. And also not used by other faculty I know, which I found, you know, kind of interesting, because a lot of this does, you know, get passed down from, you know, your colleagues making recommendations, either at other institutions or there. So I think that does argue for human resources somehow being allocated among our institutions. And we don't have a lot of spare people to do this. But if we're going to make an impact, we need a lot of librarian evangelists, but others, you know, a real partnership across our campuses and some dedicated people. And Jim has a comment.
I just want to say, too, that in regards to following up on what you said, if courses scaffold and one person in the chain goes to OER, it could throw off the entire program that was built. And there's that issue as well that needs to be considered, which is why, again, resources are necessary, because it could be a department-wide rewrite of curriculum.
I think that's how, in our situation, chemistry was able to be successful, was the chemistry department got together. They all piloted but also shadowed with an OER, and then many participated in the rewrite for the Adams First chemistry. But you're absolutely right. I think there are a few faculty members who didn't adopt, and that's going to be a real problem. But the fact that 1,800 students and nearly all faculty in all sections are using it has made a huge difference. But that's an extremely important point.
I'm sorry, sometimes the synapses don't fire correctly. To go back to Chris's comment about financial aid, I do think it's an important topic to see if we can make a recommendation on how it may be retooled to student benefit. The one concern that popped into my mind, the two I should say, is that, again, I'm going to make the caveat, I am not a financial aid expert, but I do understand that there are some state dollars that go towards financial aid, so the governor's fund. And those are from taxpayer dollars. So the concern is that the general residents of Connecticut are being taxed towards financial aid dollars that are then being used towards texts that go out. So expanding the allotment of financial aid may be helpful, but if it's basically at the taxpayer's expense, I think that's problematic. The other concern that I had on the students' behalf is that if we expand the use of financial aid for textbooks, it essentially means that the students are paying interest on a one-time book charge over the period of time, so that's a concern. But I still think it's a valid point that we should explore financial aid and see if there's a recommendation that we can make.
Yes, I mean, I wasn't trying to suggest that we should simply just up payments so that money flows through from,
right,
you know, our pockets to their pockets, but the whole question of whether accessibility of textbooks and other materials is available particularly to students for whom it is most difficult to acquire them, whether a rebalancing of financial aid policies would assist in some way in that might be something to ask the people who are experts on those things.
If there are no other comments or questions, I think we'll move on to the survey. Kevin, you have been working with your subgroup to finalize the survey that we've been talking about for a few months.
Yes. So the working group, thanks to Dan, James, and Clara, and Martha for getting to the point. I think we've got our first two deliverables. I'm going to ask for confirmation from the working group, but we have a version of the Babson survey vetted and ready to go, and I believe the University of Connecticut is graciously accepted to put it to Qualtrics.
I'm going
to
look right at Sally because she has agreed to her office will do that. Mm-hmm. Hopefully not Sally herself.
No.
And one of the other deliverables was around messaging. And so I believe we have a vetted, blessed message that is going to go out to two intended audience members. One is President Marco Jakian representing the Board of Regents, and then Executive Director Jen Widnes representing the independent schools for CCIC. And that with their assistance, they would just disseminate that message to their constituent groups. And I think we're in agreement that because the University of Connecticut had done this so recently, that we were not going to ask their faculty to participate once again.
And the questions are very similar. It's just a couple additional ones.
So what we have is we have messaging right now that is basically step one of two. One is the stressing of the importance of the survey and the asking of the two leaders to encourage their campuses to participate. Once the survey is ready, there will be a second message that goes out asking those two leaders to disseminate and promote participation in that survey. So I just want to turn to the group and say, are there any other comments, concerns, questions?
I think it's fine as revised, so I think we're all set.
Great. Do we want to talk about timing?
Okay, I'll turn it over to Sally. Obviously the messaging, that whenever you send the first message out, and then, you know, we'll have to, Sally and I will chat about when we'll be prepared to do it. And then, of course, there's the analysis piece, which is not always the easiest one. We can collect the data, then have to do something with it.
Yeah, so Qualtrics automatically, you know, tallies. So if they're quantitative questions, it's relatively simple. But I think it would be better, you get better responses if the message comes from somebody within the institution. So I would think if we're going to send it to, Board of Regents institutions, maybe it comes from faculty on this committee, for example, indicating that, you know, that you are serving on this, and so therefore it's coming to, you know, the four-year institutions, the community colleges, that would increase participation. The other thing is we could, everybody's so busy these days, we could draw a random sample. So random samples, you know, usually indicate that you're going to have more representative responses. So we could take a look at how many faculty, it's all, just going to faculty, correct? It's faculty questionnaire. So how many faculty are represented by the community colleges and the four-year state universities and draw a random sample, you know, depending on the number of items. It could be 200 or 300 faculty within each. And therefore, you know, we'd randomize and not everybody would then get it. So either of those two options, I just would need we'd need the acts to figure out how to get the names of the faculty to whom this would be distributed.
I guess the plan was that, you know, we at the University of Connecticut would not distribute it. That would be decided by the Board of Regents, would go out through the institutional,
right,
through the institutions. We would simply provide the link, the survey, the data would come to us, but the decision about who to send it to and what lists to use was really the determination of the subgroup.
Right. And it could be done by your institutional research office as well. I mean, so we could put it into a Qualtrics format and then just send it along. So if you wanted to control the data coming in, you could do that as well. I just was suggesting that one way of doing it to get a more representative look is to do a random sample. And it's, you know, it's a matter of that way people who are asked about this would be more represented, as opposed to those who have an interest, particular interest, in seeing what the topic is actually responding. So, you know, I know some of the IR folks at the Board of Regents, and Qualtrics is a very simple questionnaire format now that we use all the time. So I'm sure many of you have used it as well, but it automatically tallies, so it's very nice. So we'll set it up and then send it back to Martha and Kevin and get it probably over to Daniel and Jim, and you could let us know how, you know, what the next steps are, since you're representing your institutions. Okay.
Yeah, we'll have to see what Mocha Jakin thinks about that as well. So about Kevin, you talked to Mark about how we might disseminate the survey throughout the CSUs, the CSUs.
I haven't had the opportunity to talk in detail with Mark himself. I've been working mostly with his chief of staff, Alice, on coordination of all OER conversations. So I'm still waiting to get a little bit more clarity on how Alice would like Mark to do that.
So what you missed when you were away is we'll get the survey ready. Sally will send it to us, and then it's up to you all, the subgroup, to decide how to distribute it, whether to randomize it, whether to send it all, if it's institution by institution, whether institutions want to, you know, use the Qualtrics survey themselves and collect their own data. It's fine, but we're just going to put it in the format to get it used.
Can I ask a follow-up logistical question about that? Would this be potentially one, if you did the random,
right,
it would be one survey going to one source. It would go to UConn through the Qualtrics survey tool.
If you randomize, so we, our sexual assault survey last year, for example, we had a very good response rate. We randomized because we thought it was the right thing to do, but we randomized by campus. So we selected it's called a stratified random sample, which we selected from each of the regional campuses and then stores, and then grad students at stores. So you have a choice if you want to do a random sample of doing a random selection. And I actually recommend it just because it saves so much time and effort. You could draw a random sample from all of the community colleges. You could stratify if you wanted to by college, although we tend to do that because we have such huge differences at UConn in geography. If it's not that much of a problem, you can just do a random sample, and the four state universities also can do the same thing. That way you have 200 or 300 professors that have to take the time to do it, and you have more confidence in the representation of it. So I would suggest it's easier, but this is completely up to your institutional research folks to make a determination.
I guess why I'm asking is that if each campus is going to do it and they're going to evaluate it with Qualtrics survey tool, there may be varying levels of support to do that. Whereas if we did it in a kind of centralized way, I mean, I don't care one way or the other. I'm just thinking about the logistics campus by campus by campus and what resources they have to put into it.
Yeah, I think you generally have a better response rate when you do a sample from across multiple institutions than if you try to send it to everybody. Just mainly because you can say you've been randomly selected to participate and it's anonymous or at least confidential. You generally have a better response rate. Yeah, you can do it centrally. It could be done right through the systems office, and thereby not have a big toll on the individuals at each of the institutions. And they do. You have an institutional research person centrally, and they might even. I mean, we'll put it in a Qualtrics format, but they might even host it on the site of the Board of Regents, as opposed to individual colleges having to send it out. I hope that I'm a background stat, so I hope that made it I didn't make it too complicated.
No, I think that that's a, you know, that's a an option we should consider, because it seems like it might be an option that makes it happen more easily.
Yeah, you're not dealing with thousands and thousands of people. You know, you're dealing with a sample of maybe 300. I have to look at how many items are on the survey. We'd run a power analysis for you and then basically say you need, you know, X number of 100 faculty.
Yeah, I think the idea of a random sample makes sense to me, as well as having a central repository. So we don't want to have 17 schools all have their own databases or data, you know, across the whole state,
right,
and having to try to find some way to bring those databases together is just a nightmare, as you know, from
right,
just trying to do data analysis and such. So
yeah,
we should have one place that the data is stored at, one website that we all go to, mm-hmm, and then we can break it up by school or whatever if we need to.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree with you.
Yeah, and if you get a contact at the Board of Regents, we're happy to talk to that person, send them the survey, and put it in Qualtrics for them, or they may want to use their own system. So, you know, that'll make a determination. So if you can get somebody, Kevin, who wants to talk with us, we'd be glad to do that. But our Office of Institutional Research will definitively put it into Qualtrics format to make it easier.
I appreciate that, and I'll make the connection. I kind of lean towards what Dan's saying, is if we can have one centralized
yeah,
link that's disseminated statewide, it may make life easier than,
mm-hmm,
and unfortunately Cindy Gallatin is not here to represent the independent colleges and have
mm-hmm,
a say on this, but it may be easier just to have one location.
But still random.
Yes.
Yeah.
Somebody else we want to talk about on that?
I guess that's it for the survey. We'll be getting that done, I'm sure, within the next few weeks. Are there any updates from any of the members of the task force?
Okay. Well, sorry to dominate, but in addition to the Board of Regents' effort around the pilot and this symposium on September 30th, I had an opportunity to present to the presidents of all 17 campuses on Tuesday morning. And so while it was a very brief conversation around open education, it did leave with a possibility of convening a leadership summit around open education strategy for all 17 campuses. It appears that many of the presidents have OER as part of their institution strategy, and that it would be probably best in the system's interest if there was some kind of coordinated effort among all 17 campuses, so there seemed to be positive feedback towards that. So that's something I'm hoping to have a report back for the next time we convene. The other interesting experience I had last night was I was invited to speak with the Central Connecticut State University Student Government Association. And so they were talking about affordability, and I've also been invited to connect with Western's Student Government Association to have a similar conversation. And it sort of reemphasizes the point that I don't remember who made it about having students in on the ground floor of the conversation, because the central students are not privy to what's happening with the central faculty, staff, and administration, and so they don't know that there are some efforts being done, and there's a level of frustration. So they're just starting to have this conversation and sort of cross that bridge. So. I'm happy to be part of it. It was a tremendous learning experience for me to hear the students' perspective and the passion they have about this topic.
No, I would just reiterate the importance of students being involved in this. They were the instigators. They were the advocates. They were the leaders on our campus, and they certainly are the beneficiaries. They have the largest stakeholder. So without the students, I don't think that the University of Connecticut could have gotten as far as it has. Other updates? I had only a couple, but Sally, fortunately, talked about the new incentive. And Representative Haddad mentioned his conference. Unless you want to say any more about the pleasure it was to have so many people convened on UConn, all who are stakeholders, brought together with a Representative Haddad and Flexer. Do we have our next meeting scheduled?
We don't.
Okay. Well, we had agreed that Friday afternoons were the best. Is that, I'm hoping that's still the case and that we don't have to do another poll. October 7th, a month from now. Works for you. The members present get the most.
October 7th.
You would, Chris would be out of town. Gee, I just checked my calendar. Something's on there for October 7th. Let me see what time. Oh, you have what? You're away? Okay, so what about the following Friday the 14th? That would work. Do we want to, well, certainly be fine with me. If we have some uncertainty about it, we could do a poll of Fridays in October and find out which one worked the best, if Marianne's willing to help us out with a doodle poll. Maybe that's what we should do rather than just try to settle it here. Does that sound all right? All right, so we'll shoot for a Friday afternoon in October. That shouldn't be too difficult to a poll to send around. Are you willing to do that for us? Yes, great. Okay, thank you. Is there anything else? Well, Yes, of course. Sorry. Thank you to our guests, and you're welcome to send any follow-up information to either Kevin or to me if you've heard anything here that you think we might benefit from, and we'll be sure that it gets forwarded to the committee. So, anyway, we're done 5 minutes early. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.